The following podcast is for healthcare professionals only. All views expressed belong to our speakers and don't necessarily reflect those of Nestlé Health Science.
Hello and welcome to the Inside Medical Nutrition podcast, a podcast powered by Nestlé Health Science and hosted by me, Dr. Nanya Patel. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Michaela Profe-Fuchslasch, an assistant professor at the University of Coventry, and we'll be discussing the impact of fiber inclusion in enteral nutrition for pediatric patients. Hi, Michaela. Welcome to the Inside Medical Nutrition podcast. I'm really looking forward to our conversation, which will be focusing on looking at the impact of fiber inclusion on enteral nutrition, particularly for pediatric patients. Now, I must admit, fiber inclusion may not be necessarily the first thing that comes to mind when thinking about pediatric nutrition, but I know that this is an area of nutrition that is gaining a lot of attention. So we're going to go into that in a lot more detail. But before we do, I would love it if you could tell me and the listeners a little bit more about you.
Great. Thank you for having me, Linnea. So I'm a registered dietitian and nutritionist, and I'm also an SOS chain feeding therapist. So my background is quite varied, having done some work in adults and pediatrics, but my true love is pediatrics.
Okay.
My specialism is pediatric dysphagia and home enteral feeding, specifically for those children with neurodisabilities. I've also worked a bit in adult critical care, and I'm quite passionate about that too. But definitely pediatric home enteral feeding is my first love.
Okay. So you're a pediatric dietitian, so you do some clinical work as well. And from stalking you a little bit on LinkedIn, I know that you also work at the university in a research capacity. Is that right?
I am a full-time lecturer at Coventry University. So I don't work in clinical roles at the moment, but I have recently left clinical work. So not lecturing full, I'm going to rewind that a little bit. I would like to say, can I rewind my answer to that one?
Absolutely. Do you want me to ask it again?
Yes.
So at the moment, are you doing any clinical work? Because I know from doing a little bit of stalking on LinkedIn that you are working at a university at the moment.
I don't currently work in a clinical role, but yes, you're right. I do lecture full time in dietetics at the moment.
Okay. So where does, obviously you're passionate about pediatrics, where does enteral nutrition kind of feed in there?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that in my previous experience, I worked as a highly specialist pediatric dietitian, and I managed a caseload of about 125 children with special needs. Okay. So many of these children had complex care needs, had serious issues with their bowels, were not really doing well with their feeding. Some of these patients were reliant on sheep feeds only. Some were a mix of oral and enteral nutrition, but most of them worked really well with myself, an OT and a speech and language therapist, and it really helped us to provide the best kind of support for these patients. So for me, I found that working with these types of patients gave me an opportunity to make a real difference in the lives of these small people and their families. So it was a really rewarding career.
No, I can imagine. And then in terms of your role at university, obviously you are lecturing, so I'm assuming that an element of that is teaching dietetic students. Are there any exciting developments on the horizon in the research world that you're currently working in?
Yes. So at the moment, I am the module leader for what I believe is the only undergraduate pediatric module in dietetics in the UK at the moment.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. So I'm really quite blessed to be able to work in this role and to spread the good word about pediatrics, as we know that there is a big shortage of pediatric dietitians within the UK. So as a result of that, I'm actually working on a research project at the moment looking at how we can support recently graduated dietitians to move into pediatric roles. And this is a priority for the BDA. So looking at how we can expand the pediatric workforce.
No, that's super interesting and very needed, as you say, because it is a real speciality and a real niche. So to be able to have those very specific modules is brilliant for our students. So if we move a little bit, Michaela, and start talking about enteral feeds with fiber, why would fiber be a particularly a good addition in terms of pediatric patients?
So fiber is an exceptionally important component of enteral feeds. I could talk about this for ages, but where to begin? So fiber, as you know, is a non-digestible component of food. And there are three main ways in which we would classify fiber. So we look at the solubility, viscosity, and fermentability. So how it impacts a feeding regimen is varied. So firstly, the stool weight is increased due to the amount of water held by the fiber from the fermentation of the fiber. It also increases bacterial mass, and that improves the regularity of the bowels, which means that the stools that are formed are quite soft, and it makes it easier to pass a stool for a patient. Now, that's not the only thing. That's one of the most basic things that fiber does. But it also helps to reduce stool frequency in those who are struggling with diarrhea. And then for those who are constipated, it has the opposite effect, where it means that we have an increase in stool frequency. So what I would say is that fiber has this balancing role for the bowels. There are different clinical benefits for different types of fiber, but one of the ones that works particularly well is partially hydrolyzed guar gum, which I'll refer to as PHGG. And this has been found to prevent diarrhea in many patients. So, yeah, and I was reading around this recently. And there was a meta-analysis done in 2022, which found that fiber supplements help lessen post-feeding diarrhea in hospitalized adult patients receiving enteral nutrition. However, not all fiber types produce successful outcomes. So the interesting thing was diarrhea was significantly reduced by PHGG and a mix of soluble and insoluble fiber. So this sort of evidence highlights one of the main benefits of PHGG, and that is the reduction of diarrhea in patients who are enterally fed.
Okay, super interesting, because we've talked about the fact that there's two different types of fiber, and one part of the fiber is very good for patients with diarrhea. But I imagine there are also concerns with the fact that there's another type of fiber that might, for some sensitive digestive systems, not necessarily be beneficial. So what disease conditions in general get the most benefit from using fiber-containing formulas?
There are many different patient conditions that could benefit from a fiber-containing feed. And I would say that specifically, in my experience, patients with a neurodisability have a lot to gain from using a fiber-containing feed. And the reasons for this come down to some of the changes within the gastrointestinal system of many patients with a neurodisability. So if I look at the physiology a little bit, the function of the gut is controlled by the enteric nervous system, which functions only partially independently from the central nervous system. So the enteric nervous system controls important functions such as motility, secretion, and gastrointestinal blood flow. And the central nervous system then regulates the enteric nervous system. So now patients with a neurodisability often have some sort of disturbance or malfunctioning of that central nervous system. Okay. So what that means then is that children with a neurological disorder, there is a miscommunication in that enteric nervous system. And that means that there can be issues with gut dysmotility and symptoms such as gastroesophageal reflux, delayed gastric emptying, diarrhea, constipation, etc., which tend to commonly affect children with neurodisabilities. But it can also affect other children, and of course, adults. So quite a wide range of clinical conditions.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And I guess what you're constantly doing to see whether that feed is having a positive impact is monitoring whether or not, as you were saying, what's gut motility like? How many stools are they having? What's the type of stools, et cetera? Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I look at monitoring the tolerance for a patient, I would look at a variety of different things. So I usually ask parents or carers to keep a detailed record of symptoms. So I ask them to keep a diary looking at things like vomiting, bowel motions, any pain, abdominal distension, as well as the frequency and duration of these symptoms. So if a symptom suddenly emerges, we can sort of pinpoint what triggered that usually. And if we do realize there's a symptom that's coming up, we might change the way that we're implementing adding in a fiber product to this person's feeding regimen. So if I talk to you a little bit through around how I sort of start off introducing fiber. Would that be interesting?
No, that would be super interesting, because that was going to be one of the questions I was going to ask is, okay, well, how do you even begin, and what's the process you kind of have to go through?
Okay, so when starting a new product, whether it's a fiber-containing feed or any kind of other products, I do ask parents to give that particular product as the first feed of the day and to continue the rest of the day's feeds as the usual feed, gradually increasing by one feed a day until the feed is fully transitioned, assuming this patient is having bolus feeds, of course. Alternatively, I would transition the feed using a regrading method, which means I would ask parents to give a fraction of the new feed, okay, so approximately 25% of the day's total volume as the new feed and the rest as the current feed, and gradually increases by 25% each day over approximately 4 days. So looking at how this is done in practice, it's often done when infants are transitioned from a hydrolyzed formula to a whole protein formula. So looking around things like cow's milk protein allergy. This works really well because it's a nice and slow introduction, and it allows for minimal disruption and discomfort to the patient. In my experience, I find that directly switching between two different products can really lead to the rapid emergence of intolerance and discomfort for a patient. So it's also important to make sure that the parents, the carers, are really comfortable with how you're making the transition. So we need to check with the parents if they're okay with it. Are they on board? And once we know that they're on board, I like to check with them to please tell me how they're doing this at home, to make sure that what we've agreed on in clinic is actually what's happening at home, and that there's no sort of miscommunications or confusions about how to implement that.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I got two questions out of that. The first is, you've really laid out very clearly the process that you would use, which is perfect. I mean, are there other tools, guidance that aid clinical dietitians working on the ground to know what protocols they should follow?
That's a good question. And as far as I'm aware, there aren't really any tools available. It's very much a trial and error basis, what works for individual patients. Now, there are different guidelines available from sort of anecdotal evidence, but the advice that I would give to other dietitians is that we need to bear in mind that each patient is so individual. Yeah. And when we're working with a patient, particularly a patient with complex care needs or neurodisabilities, they have a broad range of things going on. And to apply a simple formula to these patients and a simple process is not going to always be appropriate. So we need to make sure that, that we're being led by the patient. So how are they getting on with it, and being flexible and adjusting as we go on? I think aside from that, I would always advise parents to become quite familiar with the Bristol stool charts, so they can sort of identify what the different changes of stool looks like, and so that they can describe it and document it in a way that's really helpful. I mean, as a dietitian in clinic, you often see things like poo pictures. Mm. So parents will take a picture of the poop so they can show you what has happened. And that makes it a lot easier for us to gather the information and take that forward. So it's difficult to have a standard way.
No, because we're all individuals. And I guess, as you were saying, it depends. The clinician needs to determine perhaps the level of fiber intake before, because you want to do it gradually to make sure that you've got optimal compliance, which is great.
Absolutely.
Which then brings me to my second question, Michaela, which was around parents and carers' involvement. Now, obviously, they play a significant role in the care of their children. How do you influence them to be able to work with them in a way that obviously means that it's more seamless?
So I think it's really important to have parents or carers on board when you're making any changes to a feeding regimen. I see it as a partnership. So I know the clinical nutrition aspect really well, but the parents, the carer knows their child very well. Nobody knows that child better than they do. And it would be amiss of me as a professional to assume that I have all of the understanding and all of the knowledge. So what I like to do is see it, as I say, as a partnership, and work with the parents to come up with a plan that will provide the best outcomes. So it's about building trust and building a rapport with the patients and their carers or parents, and making sure that every time that we have contact, that we get as much information and as much of an open discussion about what's happening, what their concerns are, and being able to balance out their expectations with the clinician's expectations. I think that's incredibly important. So just to sort of answer that question in totality, I would say that oftentimes a parent has come to me in clinic and said, well, I've heard about this product, I've heard about this protocol, I've spoken to this other parent, what do you think? And I think the knee-jerk reaction of many professionals is to say, no, there's no evidence for that. And yeah, it's important that we practice evidence-based nutrition, but it's also important that we understand where people are coming from and look into things. In my experience, I found that when I've made it clear to a parent that I have their child's best interest at heart, and sometimes we may need to look into alternative routes of doing things, but whatever we do has to be done safely. So it's just by finding that balance, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And the other thing you did mention, Michaela, a little bit was evidence. Now, you're working in the research world, so I'm just curious to understand, because we haven't necessarily mentioned kind of gut health and microbiota, but I'm guessing that the benefits of the fiber in terms of all the positive outcomes are linked with the microbiota. Is there kind of research in this space and area?
There is, but unfortunately, there isn't enough evidence to say exactly which fibers affect which microbes and to what extent. However, there is some information coming out about PHGG in particular, and they have found that PHGG works as a prebiotic. So it is a food source for colonic bacteria. It improves the growth of the beneficial gut bacteria. So, for example, one of the ones that it really does improve the growth of is bifidobacteria. And it has some important properties. So because it is fermentable and non-viscous, it has those amazing benefits where it results in the formation of short-chain fatty acids. So we're talking about the microbes and the microbiota. The gut bacteria breaks down this fiber, breaks down the PHGG, produces this product called the short-chain fatty acid. And that itself is a substance that feeds the cells of the colon, and that really keeps that mucosa really healthy. And that means it also helps to pass stools more easily with less discomfort, keeping that tissue healthy and less likely to be inflamed and in pain. So that's some of the ways that using things like a soluble fiber type, specifically PHGG, works particularly well for patients who are enterally fed.
No, that's very interesting. So that's the evidence showing the mechanism of how it works. Do you have any more practical, perhaps success stories that you can share from your clinical practice? And also maybe could you highlight some of the challenges that come with fiber inclusion in enteral nutrition formulas?
Yeah, so I'll talk about the challenges first, and then I'll tell you about some really good experiences that I've had in my practice. So if we look at fiber guidelines, ESPGHAN, which is the European Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, recommends increased fiber intake in children with neurodisabilities. So the ideal aim is for these children to have somewhere between 17 and 21 grams per day of fiber at a minimum. This is exceptionally ambitious. So if we consider what that means practically, most standard enteral feeding formulas or whole protein formulas of about 1 kcal per mil have virtually no fiber present in them. So if we're feeding a child this type of formula, they're not going to get any fiber. So they're not going to be meeting those requirements. Okay. Now, there are some other whole protein formulas that contain around 0.8 grams per 100 milliliters, which is a little bit better. However, there is also a new product available which contains 100% hydrolyzed whey formula. And that also has 1.2 grams per 100 mils of fiber, so PHGG in particular. Now, depending on the age and the requirements of the child, we may not deliver as much as 1 liter of feed per day or 2 liters of feed per day. So it's very difficult to reach that fiber requirement, especially if you're going to be using a feed that doesn't contain much to begin with.
Okay.
So it's very challenging to reach those fiber needs. Now, what I can say is from my personal practice, I found that there was one patient that always sticks in my mind, and I think of them all the time. This young child had a complex clinical condition, and their mum was fantastic. She had to manage lots and lots of different medications for this child, lots of adjustments to routines, and it was quite difficult because any small illness or slight alteration would cause a cascade of gut issues in this child that would last for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I remember distinctly that you know, mum felt like she was at the end of the road. She didn't know what to do anymore. Clinicians were going, well, what do we do? And I was reading so many journal articles, and I finally came across PHGG, which is a fiber that you can find as a standalone product, not just in this particular enteral formula. And I asked her if she would consider trialing adding some PHGG into the child's enteral feed, because I wondered if it might improve bowel motions and thereby reduce vomiting, reflux, and abdominal pain. So she was willing, and we started adding the fiber in quite slowly. Interestingly, within days, the mom was able to decrease the amounts of laxative she gave the child. And by the time we'd reached the full fiber prescription, he was off all laxative products and hadn't vomited in weeks. Yeah. So I know this is anecdotal, but I remember the mom ringing me to say that the product is magic. And she was so glad to be able to give her child less medication and that he was so much more settled. This really made a difference to this mom and the family. What more could a dietitian ask for?
Yeah.
So a small change like that made all the difference to this little one. Yeah, it's good.
So we talked about some of the challenges. You've given me a wonderful case study. Anything else that you want to add there?
Yeah. So I think that if we're looking at adding fiber into a feed, we need to bear in mind that there are some implications to that. So using a product that already contains the fiber is ideal simply because it reduces the risk of things like tube blockage. It reduces food safety and hygiene risks and things like that. You can also add in separate products, but that requires a lot of additional work for a parent or a carer. And it could also mean that there might be problems, as I say, with tube blockage, et cetera. So that is something that is quite important to bear in mind. Now, in terms of fiber type, again, I would say PHGG is the one to go for, particularly for patients with neurodisabilities. However, they work well for patients in other clinical conditions too. So it's not just about that one clinical condition, but I found it particularly useful in neurodisabilities.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And say if we shift the focus and look to the future, how do you see the landscape of enteral nutrition evolving for pediatric patients? More feeds with fiber, perhaps?
Hopefully. Hopefully looking at more feeds with fiber. I think one of the biggest trends at the moment, and you would have seen this from your discussions with other dietitians on your podcast, is blended diets are really becoming quite popular, and there's definitely a place for them in the world of pediatrics. However, there are some patients who blended diets just cannot work for a variety of reasons. And the biggest, I think, benefit to having a blended diet is that increase in natural food fiber and the variety of different fibers that come with using different food types. So those types of things have resulted in patients on blended diets having excellent bowel motions, massive reductions in things like vomiting, diarrhea, etc. Now, for the patients that doesn't work for various reasons, a product that contains a good amount of fiber, i.e. a commercially produced product, might be the way to go.
Yeah.
So I think that looking forward to the future, having fiber-containing feeds that have quite a bit more fiber than the average fiber-containing feed, and perhaps specific fiber types, as I would say, PHGG is one of the best ones in my experience, I think that would be ideal to see in the future.
Yeah.
I think that we're going to see benefits. Yeah, absolutely.
And you're able to have much more kind of vision around perhaps protein, how much protein it contains, all the other essential fats, etc., which perhaps are harder to obtain with a blended diet.
Yeah, so blended diets in particular can be difficult to get the right amount of protein and calories in. As we know, we often end up having to dilute them down quite a bit to get the right consistency. Whereas using a product that has a set amount of calories and protein is really helpful, especially if it's a slightly higher than standard calories. So most formulas, as we know, is about 1 calorie per mil. Anything a bit higher than that could be beneficial to patients who are struggling with malnutrition or lack of weight gain. And by it being potentially more concentrated, it also means that less feed has to be delivered to get to the same clinical results. That also means a decrease in things like vomiting and abdominal pain and things like that. So there is a big market, I guess, or a big need for products that contain more fiber and that are slightly more calorie and protein dense. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned 100% whey peptides with fiber feeds as well. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, so peptide-based feeds are known to improve tolerance and absorption of feeds, and fiber itself improves gastrointestinal symptoms. So together, these two innovations in enteral feeding tackle some of the most pressing challenges in home enteral feeding, especially for those patients who have a neurodisability and perhaps suffer from relentless gastrointestinal difficulties and poor weight gain. So there was a case study review done by Romano et al. In 2021, and this looked at the use of PHGG in functional gastrointestinal disorders in children, where two case studies were of children who were home enterally fed with 100% whey peptide formula containing PHGG. In both of these cases, these children's gastrointestinal issues had decreased significantly. Both had improvements in their growth. And this is a promising sort of case report on the benefits of combining whey peptide formulas and PHGG. I mean, we can look into it a bit further as to how peptides themselves are very helpful. So if we look at that, I would say that it's really important to bear in mind what a peptide is. So this is because you're a dietitian, but I will just whiz through this real quick. So peptide-based feeds are feeds where the protein is partially digested into smaller components. So they're really, really useful for those who have tolerance issues. So when I say tolerance issues, I mean they might be struggling with things like vomiting, reflux, diarrhea, constipation, sort of pain and things like that. And these are signs then if we observing that the child or the adult is not tolerating their feed. Now, moving over to a peptide-based feed is really helpful. If we look at some studies, the one that I read that was really interesting was a 2021 retrospective cohort study done in the USA, and they looked at the tolerance of peptide-based enteral feeds in 30 home enterally fed children. Now, these children had a variety of diagnoses, such as neurodisabilities, dysphagia, and disease-related malnutrition. So say, for example, things like Crohn's disease. They had all kinds of other things like cystic fibrosis. So it's not just neurodisabilities. Anyway, they found in their analysis that there is a statistically significant difference in gastrointestinal symptoms experienced by children who were transitioned from a whole protein feed to a peptide-based feed. And the reduction of symptoms was across the range of GI symptoms, so such as diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal discomfort and pain, bloating, and constipation. So overall, this means that peptide-based feeds were better tolerated by children who were home enterally fed when transitioned onto peptide-based feeds. And now some of the reasons for this might be due to the formulation of the product. So looking at the types of fat that is present. So in peptide-based feeds, we tend to have a high proportion of MCT fats, which are absorbed directly through the small bowel. And also the peptides themselves, they're much more gentle on the small bowel, especially for those who have had some mucosal damage from persistent diarrhea. These peptides are much better absorbed by the patients. And that means that we can actually take them up better and result in then lean tissue growth in that patient. So combining the benefits of the fiber with the benefits of a peptide-based feed might mean that we're seeing the benefits of both in these patients. Of course, we need more evidence as time goes on, but I think it's very promising.
Great. Now, Michaela, before we conclude, I would love it if you could provide some of our listeners with practical tips or perhaps your main take-home messages about how they can incorporate more fiber into enteral nutrition or perhaps how they can use these types of feeds for their pediatric patients.
Well, the main takeaways for professionals is that I would strongly encourage any dietitian to carefully consider your clinical reasoning for the products and regimens you are using in managing your home enterally fed patients, and consider how incorporating a fiber-containing product may improve your patient's symptoms and their overall quality of life. I think so often we accept that there is a whole bunch of medications prescribed to a patient and that we just need to leave them be. But actually, we can adjust these medications. Well, not say we, the multidisciplinary team can do that. So if you, as a dietitian, have some thoughts about this, have discussions with your patient's consultant or GP, work together to find ways where you can minimize the need for additional pharmaceutical products, such as laxatives, and think about harnessing the power of fiber to give your patients and their family an opportunity to have a reduced medication burden and improve their quality of life. I think then for patients or parents or carers, I would advise you to have a chat with your child's dietitian and ask about whether there's any scope for trialing a fiber-containing product. It may be that your child has settled into a predictable routine or pattern, and there might be some reluctance from yourself or from a healthcare professional to upset that delicate balance. But without trying something new, you'll never know if things could have been better for your child or your family. So don't be afraid to step out and try something new.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And Michaela, I'm a dietitian as well, and fiber is my favorite nutrient. It was at the beginning, and you've definitely consolidated that. So thank you so much for your expertise and for coming onto this podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Medical Nutrition. If you enjoyed the podcast and found the content useful, please share it with your colleagues. And consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. For more information on this topic or to share your feedback, please visit the Nestle Health Science N+ Hub or click on the link in the show notes.